Welcome to the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. Show notes, links, and contact details can be found at robnunphoto.com. That's www.robnunphoto.com. SCL is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network, and loads of other great tech podcasts can be found over at www.techpodcast.com. Now on with the show. The Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. This is show 113 for the 13th of September 2010. Again, I need to apologise for slipping the podcast slightly late into the feed this week. I didn't get a chance to do it yesterday, Sunday. We were out and about. We were actually watching an ice hockey match at the Gosport Ice Rink, and it was Gosport Solent Devils versus another team, and I'm pleased to say they won. I think it was 9-5 they won in the end, but that was great because Oliver has been going ice skating a lot recently and fancies taking up ice hockey, so we went along to see what it was like, and it was great fun, really good, good atmosphere. Well, I'm Rob from robnunphoto.com, and this is my little podcast all about my sort of journeys through photography, and I guess my journey to try and become a better photographer, even though we all know, and I think we know, that the best way to become a better photographer is to take lots of photographs and look at lots of great photographs, and then you just get better naturally. Now, this podcast is brought to you by GoToMeeting.com. They're our sponsor. Basically, GoToMeeting is a online conference call system whereby you can talk to colleagues, you can talk to customers, you can talk to anybody you like over the internet, and the big difference is that they can see your PC screen. So you can imagine we were doing the podcast now and you're listening to it, and when I'm talking about the photographs from like our Flickr group, we go to meeting instead of me just talking and you having to find it on the internet, or maybe you listen to this on your laptop somewhere. What you can do with GoToMeeting, you could actually be looking at what's on my desktop, so you could see the pictures I was talking about. You could see the photographs I've taken of the books I talk about and the cameras I bought at the car boot sale. So what I'd like you to do is, if you're interested, go to the URL gotomeeting.com/techpodcast and try it out free for 30 days. That's gotomeeting.com/techpodcast. Okay, so yesterday, obviously Sunday, car boot day as ever. What did I pick up at the car boot sale? Well, only one thing, and it was it was a digital back. But what a digital back! Digital back. What am I talking about? It's a film back. Wish I'd found a digital back. No, film back. I got a Canon EOS 50E SLR single lens reflex film body. It's a beauty. You may have heard me talk about my EOS 50E many, many moons ago, and the 50E was the camera that got me into the Canon SLR and the Canon DSLR photography system, because originally, was it 2 years ago now, I think I bought a 50E with a Canon EF autofocus lens on it from the car boot, and once I got the lens, I then got the 350D digital SLR. And that got me into sort of buying lenses and Canon lenses and manual focus M42 lens, etc. But anyway, I cannot resist a bargain when we go to the car boot sales. And one of the first stalls we looked at, this guy had, I saw the 50E and recognised it straight away because it's a big old body. It's a semi-pro body, the 50E, so it's a good old size. It's got like a plastic bottom to it and a metal alloy top. It's got the dials on the top of it, control wheel on the back, etc. Really nice body. Imagine a top end digital SLR, well, any current DSLR, all the things that can do in terms of aperture priority, shutter priority, program mode, fully automatic mode, different metering mode, 3 frames per second, all that stuff. The 50E can do it, and it also has this rather funky eye control as well. And I said, how much do you want for it, mate? And he said, £8. £8. I mean, I don't know how much these bodies were when they were new, but they must have been hundreds and hundreds of pounds. Even had a battery in it that works, and the batteries are normally about 12 quid for this sort of thing, so I couldn't resist it. I picked it up and took it away. So that's now sitting proudly next to my other 50E body as I guess a kind of a backup. But what I'm thinking about doing with this one is just whacking the 50mm 1.8 on it and just blowing a roll of film for it, because I also managed to pick up some cheap film. I think I got 3 rolls for £1 off some stall or other. And I've actually got quite a big pile of film now. I've probably got about 15, 20 rolls, so I've got to start making my way through it. And I've been hard at work this week, and we've been working on the allotment and that sort of thing. So I haven't really been doing that much digital photography, but I have been shooting away merrily while we've been down the allotment or out and about with my two compact film cameras, which is the Olympus Mew 2, or Olympus Mew Epic, I think it's called in America, which is this gorgeous, gorgeous, tiny little compact camera that's got a 35mm f2.8 fixed lens in it, with autofocus, auto-wind. I mean, it's about the smallest size a 35mm camera can get, and it's lovely, it's lovely. But I've also been shooting with the Olympus Trip 35, so I've put some film in the one I've got, and I've been enjoying the viewfinder experience you get with the Olympus Trip 35. And again, I think I picked this up, Oliver picked this up for a couple of quid for me from one of the local second-hand shops, because it's just so simple to use. You know, it doesn't require any batteries. You just put the film in, you put it on automatic. And depending on the light conditions, the camera will change the shutter speed to either a 40th of a second or a 100th of a second, and then it will change the aperture to give you a correct exposure. And I think it's great. You know, I mean, how simple is that? No batteries to worry about. Just shoot film. So that's what I've been doing. But I am itching to get out with my digital SLR and take some more photographs and get on with one of my first initial revamped project, which is taking a load of pictures of my Polaroids, well, instant cameras, and then getting out and taking some pictures with the Instax Mini. But back to today's or tonight's podcast, I thought what I'd like to do, bear with me with this, is read from a book. Now this book is the Art of Photography, 1839 to 1989, and it was produced in about 1989 to accompany a photo exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, the Australian National Gallery in Canberra, and the Royal Academy of Arts in London. This great photo travelling exhibition with this fantastic book, which is hundreds of pages long and has some of the most famous photographs and varied photographs in any photo book I've seen. It's absolutely huge. I dread to think what this book cost new. It doesn't even have a price on, but it must have been, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds. All the photographs are printed on beautiful paper, and it's just very, very nice indeed. But anyway, amongst the hundreds of beautiful photographs, there are also some interesting essays. And I thought what I'd like to do is just read a few of them. And they kind of span a period of photography from 1859 through to 1984. And I don't know, they're just interesting essays, and I thought it might be interesting to read them. Now, they are excerpts from the book, so hopefully I'm not completely contravening copyright laws. But this, you know, this exhibition did finish, you know, almost 20 years ago, so hopefully nobody will hold it against me. So the first one is by a guy called Francis Firth, and it's an excerpt from his work The Art of Photography, which was published in 1859. The Art of Photography. Next to the truthfulness of photography, its most striking peculiarities are its somewhat mechanical character and the rapidity with which its results are produced. These characteristics can constitute the chief element of the extent and popularity of the practice of photography, just as its truthfulness is the greatest charm of its results. It was perfectly natural and inevitable that when this art began to excite universal attention, the whole body of skilled draftsmen looked upon it with jealousy and distrust. It is inevitable that many artists must continue to dislike or to despise it. We can even imagine that some, who held it as a beautiful thing, and who even made a partial and timid use of it, have harboured it as they would a tame snake, giving it a good switching now and then, lest it should grow rampant and bite. It is evident that some classes of artists had substantial cause to dread it. It has already almost entirely superseded the craft of the miniature painter, and is upon the point of touching with an irresistible hand several other branches of skilled art. But quite apart from interested motives, there was, and there continues to be, a reasonable jealousy, not so much of the art itself or its capabilities, as of its pretensions and the spirit of its practice. We do not participate in these fears because we are convinced of two things with reference to this subject. Firstly, that to practice the art with distinction, which will very shortly be, if it be not now, the only kind of practice which will command notice, requires a much greater acquaintance with the principles of art than would seem to be applicable to a merely mechanical science. And secondly, we are convinced that no extravagant pretensions can long be maintained in the public mind. Photography does not even now profess to be the high art, or in any way a substitute for it. We shall endeavour to define clearly, at a future time, both what in our opinion it has done, and what it may yet hope to accomplish, and we shall not hesitate also to exhibit what we consider it has not done, and what, in our humble opinion, it can never, in the nature of things, hope to do. The class of persons, now a very large one, who practice photography is undoubtedly a very different class from the old regime of artists. It certainly includes a vast number who know nothing, and if we judge by their crimes, care less for the principles, we will not say of art, but of common sense and decency. But even these, its practice, how degrading soever to an artist, may insensibly benefit. Whatever art may, in the opinion of some, suffer from photography, that large class of the public who are sunk so far below art will unquestionably reap from it a more than compensating advantage. We do not believe in its power to deter any youth to whom nature has given an artist's eye and heart from a proper cultivation of whose tastes and talents from which he is gifted. Your most accomplished artist, if he will stoop to the task, will ever be your best photographer, and your skilful manipulator, if he be possessed likewise of a grain of sense or perception, will never rest until he has acquainted himself with the rules which are applied to art in its higher walks, and he will then make it his constant and most anxious study how he can apply these rules to his own pursuit. And this, although no easy matter, and a thing not to be perfected in a day, he will find to be a study which will admit of the most varied and satisfactory application. The rapidity of production of which the merely mechanical process of photographic picture making is capable may easily become a source of great mischief. The student should bear in mind that what he is to aim at is not the production of a large number of good pictures, but if possible, of one which shall satisfy all the requirements of his judgment and taste. That one, when produced, will be, we need not say, of infinitely greater value to his feelings and reputation than a laneful or merely good pictures. Think of the careful thought and labour which are expended over every successive piece of canvas, and the months of patient work which are requisite to a perfect first-class steel plate. And then turn to the gentleman who describes a machine which he has contrived for taking 6 dozen pictures a day. Every one of them, this is the distressing part of the business, every one of them capable of throwing off as many impressions as the steel plate. We shudder to think of the thousands of vile negatives boxed up at this moment in holes and corners, any one of which may, on a sunny day, hatch a brood of hateful positives. We feel it to be a solemn duty to remind photographers of the responsibilities which they incur by harbouring these dangerous reproductive productions, and we beg of them, for their own sakes and for that of society, to lose no time in washing off or otherwise destroying by far the greater part of their negative possessions. what a great article that is by Francis Firth. Really cool. Again, you know, take these as you will, and if they've given you any ideas or thoughts, you know, just send me an email, scalespeeder@gmail.com. Maybe the, you know, something will resonate with what's happening today. Okay, our next one. I've jumped forward in time quite a bit. We've jumped forward to 1952. And what we have here is an excerpt from Henri Cartier-Bresson's The Decisive Moment. In photography, there is a new kind of plasticity, a product of the instantaneous lines made by movements of the subject. We work in unison with movement as though it were a presentiment of the way in which life itself unfolds. But inside movement, there is one moment at which the elements in motion are in balance. Photography must seize upon this moment and hold it immobile, the equilibrium of it. The photographer's eye is perpetually evaluating. A photographer can bring coincidence of line simply by moving his head a fraction of a millimetre. He can modify perspectives by a slight bending of the knees. By placing the camera closer to or farther from the subject, he draws a detail, and it can be subordinated or he can be tyrannized by it. But he composes a picture in very nearly the same amount of time it takes to click the shutter at the speed of reflex action. Sometimes it happens that you stall, delay, wait for something to happen. Sometimes you have the feeling that here are all the makings of a picture except for just one thing that seems to be missing. But what one thing? Perhaps someone suddenly walks into your range of view. You follow his progress through the viewfinder. You wait and wait, and then finally you press the button and you depart with the feeling, although you don't know why, that you've really got something. Later, to substantiate this, you can take a print of this picture, trace on it the geometric figures which come up under analysis, and you'll observe that if the shutter was released at the decisive moment, you have instinctively fixed a geometric pattern without which the photograph would have been both formless and lifeless. Composition must be one of our constant preoccupations, but at the moment of shooting it can only stem from our intuition. For we are out to capture the fugitive moment, and all the interrelationships involved are on the move. In applying the golden rule, the only pair of compasses at the photographer's disposal is his own pair of eyes. Any geometrical analysis, any reducing of the picture to a schema, can be done only, because of its very nature, after the photograph has been taken, developed and printed. And then it can only be used for a post-mortem examination of the picture. I hope we will never see the day when Photoshop sell a little schema grills to clamp onto our viewfinders, and that the golden rule will never be found etched on our ground glass. Bit wrong there, I'm afraid, Henri. If you start cutting or cropping a good photograph, it means death to the geometrically correct interplay of proportions. Besides, it very rarely happens that a photograph which was feebly composed can be saved by reconstruction in its composition under the darkroom's enlarger. The integrity of vision is no longer there. There is a lot of talk about camera angles, but the only valid angles in existence are the angles of the geometry of composition, and not the ones fabricated by the photographer who falls flat on his stomach or performs other antics to procure his effects. Interesting. Little discussion from Henri Cartier-Bresson. Again, any thoughts, just email me, scalespeeder@gmail.com. Next we have a short article, Robert Capa, and this is taken from Slightly Out of Focus from 1947. I would say that the war correspondent gets more drinks, more girls, better pay and greater freedom than the soldier. But at this stage of the game, having the freedom to choose his spot and being allowed to be a coward and not be executed for it is his torture. The war correspondent has his stake, his life, in his own hands, and he can put on it this horse or that horse, or he can put it back in his pocket at the very last minute. I am a gambler. I decided to go with E Company in the first wave. And he's talking about D-Day here, the invasion of France on the 6th of June 1944. Once I decided to go in with the first assault ships, I began to convince myself that the invasion would be a pushover and that all this talk about an impregnable West Wall was just German propaganda. My beautiful France looked sordid and uninviting, and a German machine gun spitting bullets around the barge fully spoiled my return. The beach that Kappa was going in on the first wave on was Omaha Beach, famously reproduced in Steven Spielberg Saving Private Ryan. So imagine that as I'm talking about this. The men from my barge waded in the water, waist-deep with rifles ready to shoot, with the invasion obstacles and the smoking beach in the background. This was good enough for the photographer. I paused for a moment on the gangplank to take my first real picture of the invasion. The boatswain, who was in an understandable hurry to get the hell out of there, mistook my picture-taking attitude for explicable hesitation and helped me make up my mind with a well-aimed kick in the rear. The water was cold and the beach still more than 100 yards away. The bullets tore holes in the water around me, and I made for the nearest steel obstacle. A soldier got there at the same time, and for a few minutes we shared its cover. He took the waterproofing off his rifle and began to shoot without much aiming at the smoke-hidden beach. The sound of his rifle gave him enough courage to move forward, and he left the obstacle to me. It was a foot larger now, and I felt safe enough to take pictures of the other guys hiding just like I was. It was still very early and very grey for good pictures, but the grey water and the grey sky made the little men dodging under the surrealistic designs of Hitler's anti-invasion brain trust very effective. I finished my pictures and the sea was cold in my trousers. Reluctantly, I tried to move away from the steel pole, but the bullets chased me back every time. 50 yards ahead of me, one of our burnt-out amphibious tanks stuck out of the water and offered me my next cover. I sized up the situation. There was little future for the elegant raincoat heavy on my arm. I dropped it and made for the tank. Between floating bodies I reached it, paused for a few more pictures, and gathered my guts for the last jump to the beach. Now the Germans played all their instruments, and I could not find any hole between the shells and bullets that blocked the last 20 yards to the beach. I just stayed behind my tank, repeating a little sentence from my Spanish Civil War days. Es usa cosa muy seria. Es usa cosa muy seria. This is a very serious business. The next shell fell even closer. I didn't dare take my eyes off the finder of my contacts and frantically shot frame after frame. Half a minute later, my camera jammed. My roll was finished. I reached in my bag for a new roll, and my wet, shaking hands ruined the roll before I could insert it in my camera. I paused for a moment, and then I had it bad. The empty camera trembled in my hands. It was a new kind of fear shaking my body from toe to hair and twisting my face. I unhooked my shovel and tried to dig a hole. The shovel hit stone under the sand and I hurled it away. The men around me lay motionless. Only the dead on the waterline rolled with the waves, and LCI braved the fire and medics with red crosses painted on their helmets poured from it. I did not think, and I didn't decide it. I just stood up and ran towards the boat. I stepped into the sea between two bodies and the water reached to my neck. The riptide hit my body and every wave slapped my face under my helmet. I held my cameras high above my head and suddenly I knew that I was running away. I tried to turn but couldn't face the beach and told myself, I'm just going to dry my hands on that boat. Our boat was listing and we slowly pulled away from the beach to try and reach the mothership before we sank. I went down to the engine room, dried my hands, and put fresh films in both cameras. I got up on deck again in time to take one last picture of the smoke-covered beach. Then I took some shots of the crew giving transfusions on the open deck. An invasion barge came alongside and took us off the sinking boat. The transfer of the badly wounded on the heavy seas was a difficult business. I took no more pictures. I woke up in a bunk. My naked body was covered with a rough blanket. On my neck a piece of paper read, Exhaustion case, no dog tags. My camera bag was on the table and I remembered who I was. In the second bunk was another naked young man, his eyes staring at the ceiling. The tag around his neck only said, Exhaustion case. He said, I am a coward. He was the only survivor from the 10 amphibious tanks that had preceded the first waves of infantry. All these tanks had sunk in the heavy seas. He said he should have stayed back on the beach. I told him that I should have stayed on the beach myself. The engines were humming. Our boat was on its way back to England. During the night, the man from the tank and I both beat our breasts, each insisting that the other was blameless, that the only coward was himself. In the morning, we docked at Weymouth. A score of hungry newspapermen who had not been allowed to go along on the invasion were waiting for us on the pier to get the first personal experience stories of the men who had reached to the beachhead and returned. I learned that the only other war correspondent photographer assigned to the Omaha beach had returned 2 hours earlier and had never left his boat, never touched the beach. He was now on his way back to London with his terrific scoop. I was treated as a hero. I was offered a plane to take me to London to give a broadcast of my experience, but I still remember the night enough and refused. I put my films in the press bag, changed my clothes, and returned to the beachhead a few hours later on the first available boat. 7 days later, I learned that the pictures I had taken on Easy Red were the best of the invasion. But the excited darkroom assistant, while drying the negatives, had turned on too much heat and the emulsions had melted and run down before the eyes of the London office. Out of 106 pictures in all, only 8 were salvaged. The captions under the heat-blurred pictures read that Capper's hands were badly shaking. That's brilliant, that, isn't it? That was an excerpt by Robert Capper from his slightly out of focus. Now, a change of gear for our last little excerpt. This is from Helmut Newton, rather controversial photographer, some would say. Very striking images. Look him up on the web. Plenty of stuff out there. And this is what he has in The Art of Photography. Ever since I saw La Dolce Vita, I've been very interested in the phenomenon of the paparazzi, a totally new breed of press photographers. This is why I'm now in Rome. It is only in Rome that one can find them. Later, of course, the idea of paparazzi photography spread all over the world. I have asked Linea Italiana, for which I am working, to arrange a contact with some of these people, as I want to hire half a dozen of them to pose with my model, and I want the real thing. So an appointment has been set up for me to meet the head man at the Café Greco, which is their headquarters. At 5 p.m. I'm at the bar drinking a cup of coffee with him. In front of him, next to his coffee cup, is a packet of cigarettes. He says to me, "See the man at the other end of the bar? He is a high functionary in the intelligence service. He's embroiled in a big scandal at the moment. I've been trying to get a picture of him, and I just got it." The cigarette pack contained a tiny camera, and he had been shooting all the time while we were having our coffee. I was very impressed. He explained to me that the paparazzi always work in twos. They will wait outside a restaurant where they know that a certain celebrity is dining. Then, when the man comes out, one of the photographers will create a scene. He might provoke him, pushing him a bit. The victim will get angry, protect his dinner companion, generally a glamorous woman. The paparazzo will jump out of the way, leaving the field clear for his partner to shoot the pictures fast with a flash. Very ingenious and effective. Most of these young men with cameras are completely untrained in photography. They're country lads who come to Rome. The headman gives them cameras, explains the basic rudiments. At night, working with a flash, the exposure never changes. In daytime, a fill-in flash is always used, technically simple and perfectly adequate for what certain newspapers and magazines require. What is highly developed is a network of information on who dines with whom at what place, often couples who would not wish to be seen together in public. The headman introduces me to the guys who will pose for me. A price for the 3-day shoot is agreed and we start work. I explain that I want them to treat my model as if she were a celebrity, to give no quarter and work exactly in the way they would normally would. I tell them that I will shoot very fast and get the scenes as they create them. After the second day, one of the guys comes to me and tells me that two of his colleagues have loaded their cameras with film and have taken shots of the model and me and have found out how much I am getting for my photographs and have put together a nice little expose which he has sold in advance to one of the tabloids. It takes all the persuasion of an Italian friend of mine who is a whopping big trip to get the rolls of film back. At the end of the third day, my model is completely exhausted and hysterical from the constant pummeling, running, and goading she has undergone. So there we go, 4 essays from the book The Art of Photography, which was created to go along with the photography exhibition of the same name. I hope they were interesting and thought-provoking. I enjoyed reading them. I hope you enjoyed listening to them. My name's Rob from robnonferro.com, and hopefully, pretty soon, I'll be seeing you on Flickr.